There is a biblical basis for integrity, and if we look at integrity, it's being honest and having strong moral principles and moral uprightness. And the Bible says, "I know, my God, that you test the heart and are pleased with integrity. May integrity and uprightness protect me, because my hope, Lord, is in you. And whoever walks in integrity walks securely." In Mark, people came to Jesus and said, "Teacher, we know that you are a man of integrity." They could tell by the way he lived that he had integrity. Job was commended by God to Satan when this is a man of integrity here. Anyway, in 2 Corinthians, it says, "Our conscience testifies that we have conducted ourselves in the world, and especially in our relationship with you, with integrity and godly sincerity." So integrity is important. And being a scientist, I have doctorates in both chemistry and in computer and information science, so it's important for me to look at integrity. In Obama's speech to the National Academy of Science in 2013, he said, "What is so necessary for us to continue our scientific advance, and then a fidelity to facts and truth, a willingness to follow where the evidence leads." Oh, I wish that were true. We've got to make sure that we are supporting the idea that we are not subject to politics, that they're not skewed by an agenda, that, as I said before, we make sure that we go where the evidence leads us. Amen. Let's go where evidence leads. Science as we don't know it is not science. Ever stop to think about that? So in all kinds of scenarios, the origin of life might have come about by, that's not science. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit about that later. There's all kinds of speculation nowadays on PBS and elsewhere on the multi-universe, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But that's not science. There's no evidence for it. So, anyway. Are speculative scenarios science? For me, it's very important. Almost everything I learned in the American Chemical Society, from molecules to man, you had organic molecules that developed and eventually led all the way up to man, and by just undirected natural processes through chemical evolution, then biological evolution. But all the chemical evolutionary scenarios that I learned in my first degree in chemistry have been debunked by science. They're not true. There's a PBS program entitled "What Darwin Never Knew." It's a good example of a non-explanation. There is one little part at minute 39 that talks about a gene modification that changes the color of a mouse. That's the only thing that is has to do directly with the modification of the genome. All the other evidence involved turning on and off pre-existing genes. So what that's like saying, when I turn on a light switch, oh, I created electricity, or I created light. No, all I did was turn on or off something that was already there. And that's what that whole program, two-hour program, was all about. No new information, no source of new information was presented at all in that whole program, except for that one minor mouse coloration, and that was it. They spent probably 15 minutes on that two-hour program talking about the tectolic. They were looking for the transition between fish and tetrapods, four-limbed creatures. And when they found it, they said, that proves evolution's true, because we were looking for it and we found it, the transitional form. This fish looks like it has fins that could be used for legs, almost a tetrapod. Four-limbed creature. But then it goes on to say, The genes needed to make the arms and legs were already being carried around in this prehistoric fish. The genes are already there. All they were is switched on or off. So it didn't create anything new, even according to their program. But 2 years later, there's a Nature publication that identified a fully formed tetrapod that was dated millions of years older than the tectalic. So the tectalic could not have been the transitional form between fish and tetrapods. It could not have been, because there are fully formed tetrapods that are older. Okay? Anyway. An interesting observation. Biological functionality is turning out to be much more highly specified and precise than we had originally envisioned. Biology is really a science of engineering, where constraints and biofunctionality are extreme to the point that nearly every molecular interaction is remarkably precise and tightly controlled. Molecular biology is like a jigsaw puzzle where each piece must fit precisely, specifically, into the shape with other pieces around it. And what happens is, as scientists peel back layers to find something that, maybe we can understand it better, what happens is it opens up cans of worms that makes it more complex and increases the complexity rather than make it simpler and easier to understand. Phil Skell, a member of the National Academy of Science, writes that Darwinian evolution, whatever its other virtues, does not provide a fruitful heuristic for experimental biology. It simply doesn't. There are many other things. This is a very interesting graph that was supposed to be an illustration of how evolution works. At the very left-hand side, we have the origination of the first cell. That split, you don't have to read this, by the way, that split into other categories and ultimately formed all of the current-day phyla. But what's interesting to me about this whole thing, the black portions of this are fossils that have been found. Notice any transitional fossils in this chart that's supposed to illustrate how evolution works? On any of the things here, there aren't any. The fossils appear fully formed and they stay constant. They don't morph into something different. They stay constant until either they go extinct or they remain to the present day. You don't see fossil evidence for things morphing into something different. And this was supposed to show evolution. They stopped showing this, by the way, because it doesn't show evolution. It shows that there's a lack of evolution. Anyway. On the other hand, the Bible says everything was reproducing according to its kind. And one of the scientists says most of the animal phyla that are represented in the fossil record first appeared fully formed in the Cambrian. The Cambrian is the very oldest layer of rock that contains any fossils. And it says most of the animals appeared fully formed suddenly. Interesting. No predecessors. The fossil record is therefore of no help with respect to the origin and early diversification of various animal phyla. But yet that's, of course, what is talked about all the time. Richard Dawkins, a very strong evolutionary proponent, says concerning the invertebrates, it's as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. That's Richard Dawkins saying that. They just suddenly appeared. Wow, isn't that amazing? But the fossil record, on the other hand, does support creation with a multitude of life in the very oldest fossil-bearing rocks and the fixity of species over eons of time with no transitional forms that have been verified, although many have been claimed, like the Tiktaalik, for example, was claimed for, it probably still is claimed, but even though there was something that is older that couldn't have been. Here's a real interesting thing. When I was in London, I went to the British Museum of Natural History, and they had a cast of the Laetoli footprints, and they had statues of these prehistoric-looking hominids, very hairy, very ape-like, walking along the Laetoli plain, and those beings there left footprints that look like that. And what is very intriguing about that is that they look so human-like, the footprints, that some scientists had a hard time believing that they were made by Australopithecus africanus, which is Lucy's species, the only human ancestor known to live at that time. And the footprints are indistinguishable from those of modern humans. Indistinguishable. You get that? So why do they show them hunched over, hairy, walking along the plain? Because they were dated 3.7 million years ago, and modern humans didn't live then. So therefore, they must have been ape-like. That's their conclusion. And they build stories around, not around the evidence, they base the stories on their presuppositions rather than why, I mean, obviously, if that's true, feet evolved first. Right? Because the feet are fully human, modern, matching modern humans, even though their bodies are still hunched over and hairy and all kinds of other things looking very much like apes. There's a really good famous one, Nebraska Man. They had a family and a fire and everything else. They found out later, after more investigation, that all of this stuff was based on a single tooth. And that tooth turned out to be a tooth of a pig. But that doesn't matter. They're looking for some missing link between animals and human beings. So whenever they can get something that they can claim as a missing link, they do so. And there are many other cases, but that's probably one of the more famous ones. There was an article that was published in the journal Science, the premier journal of scientific endeavors. The title was Defeating Creationism in the Courtroom but Not in the Classroom. And they were lamenting the fact that only 28% of biology teachers in high school teach evolution like they should. And they had a solution to it. Their solution was, we recommend that those who cannot accept evolution as a matter of faith to pursue other careers. You don't have to accept evolution on the basis of evidence. You have to accept it as a matter of faith. And if you can't, you don't belong as a science teacher. That's what the journal Science published. And they refused to publish my rebuttal to that. That's available on my website, by the way. My website is 4iam.org. The PDF of this talk is also on there that you can get that anytime. I put it on this afternoon. But anyway, such statements as this really destroy the credibility of science. Because if evolution has to be accepted as a matter of faith, what's the purpose of evidence? And, you know, I think, and part of this whole problem, and there's some brochures in the back and on my website that talk about USSCI.info has some information on how this kind of stance has affected our national security. Think about it. This country was established on Judeo-Christian principles. What's the first thing that happens when you get into science? Everything happened by undirected natural processes through the evolutionary process, and you're just stupid if you believe in God. Well, how many Christians do you think there are that would like to pursue a field of study that sought to demolish their core beliefs? Very few. Consequently, not very many strong Christians go into science because of what they try to push over into their minds. Therefore, our country is suffering because we are falling behind in math and science because the Christians are not going to school in science. And what I found in my talks around the world is that Christians tend to be scientifically illiterate because they're afraid of what they'll find out. And I keep telling people, no, don't be afraid. Real science supports the biblical stances in many, many cases a whole lot better than the artificial scenarios that are portrayed as science. There was a publication last October called Does Evolutionary Theory Need a Rethink? People are starting to realize evolutionary theory doesn't work. And more people are recognizing that. The number of biologists calling for a change in how evolution is conceptualized is growing rapidly. Strong support comes from allied disciplines, particularly the developmental biology, but also genomics and epigenetics, and we won't get into all those things, ecology and social sciences. We contend that evolutionary biology needs revision if it is to benefit fully from these other disciplines. The data supporting our position grows stronger every day. And they say, yet, the mere mention of the extended evolutionary synthesis often evokes an emotional, even hostile reaction among evolutionary biologists. And the British Royal Society just published this month a more detailed stance on the extended evolutionary synthesis, which is what they recommend now to replace Darwinism, because more and more scientists, literally thousands of scientists, are acknowledging Darwinism doesn't work. It's dead. It just hasn't been buried yet. But that evokes emotional or even hostile reaction among the evolutionary biologist. So I don't know how long it's going to take, but it will happen. They just have to be clothespins on your nose or something, I don't know. Anyway, going to a different topic here. The origin of mass and energy is unknown to science. There's all kinds of scenarios that have been proposed. One of the scenarios is there's an oscillating universe. The current expansion of our universe started with the Big Bang, and eventually gravity will slow it down and start to contract, and then it'll big crunch, and then it'll start all over again, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, forever. It's called the oscillating universe. A couple of big problems with that. One of them is that it will violate the second law of thermodynamics, which said entropy or randomness is continually increasing. If something has existed forever, it would be totally run down. There would be no work being done. It would be dead. That's a law, scientific law, that always has been observed to happen. The other problem is that the universe is expanding at a rate that's faster than the escape velocity, and therefore it can't slow down. And that puzzles people, so therefore they say, well, it's probably driven by dark energy, things that we can't see, but it must be something is inserting energy into this to make it expand faster. Well, the Bible talks about God stretching out the heavens, and you know, I don't know if that's what he's doing there, but anyway. Another scenario that's often portrayed for the origin of mass and energy of the universe is you have vacuum, nothing, absolutely nothing. And inside that vacuum, you have quantum fluctuations that suddenly pop out of it the mass and energy of the universe. Okay. That's interesting. The more common view nowadays is that there are whole bunches of other universes out there, and at some point in the distant past, two of those universes collided to produce our universe. We have colliding universes. But it has been estimated that in order to see the fine-tuning that we see in our universe, you would need at least 10 to the 500th universes, at least, in order to have a reasonable hope of getting the fine-tuning that we see in our universe. 10 to the 500 is 1 followed by 500 zeros. There's only 10 to the 80th, 1 followed by 80 zeros, atoms in the entire universe. So that number is so far beyond what we can even imagine that it's not hardly worth speaking about. But the other thing that's troublesome about the multi-universe, the universe, by definition, is everything there is. If there is multiple universes, there are multiple everything there is-es, which doesn't make any sense grammatically nor logically. But anyway, that's the way it goes. The other thing that makes it hard is that we can only see things and study things in our universe. We cannot study anything outside of our universe, so even if it were true that there are other universes, they would be outside of our scientific investigation and therefore would not be science to us. Then another possibility is that there's some kind of an infinite energy being that converts mass or otherwise supernaturally creates the universe. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, you ever stop to think about when God said, "Let there be the mass and energy of the universe"? The equivalent energy was released to say that when it says the word of the Lord is powerful. 520 million, trillion, 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 trillion atomic bombs worth of energy were released when he said that in order to create the mass and energy of this universe. That's a lot of energy. So when the Bible says the word of the Lord is powerful, you can believe it. Anyway, all four of these scenarios have unprovable, unverifiable, unfalsifiable assumptions, and they're not bound by known science. They're all belief systems. They're philosophical or theological belief systems. I can't prove to you that the God of the Bible is the one who did it, but it certainly would satisfy the criteria for doing so if what I believe about God is true. But it is no more scientific to believe in a natural scenario than to believe in a supernatural scenario, since known science can't account for the origin. And most of the scenarios violate the conservation of mass and energy or increasing entropy. The only one that doesn't is the creation scenario, because the energy that was used to produce this universe came from God. That's what it says. By his word, the universe was created. That's what the Bible says. So that doesn't violate any known scientific laws even. He just took some of his infinite energy and used that to create the mass and energy of the universe. No problem. He knows how to do that. Anyway. But the fine-tuned nature of the universe is scientifically knowable and studyable. There's all kinds of things that this constants for the strong and weak nuclear forces, and electromagnetic and gravitational forces, the ratio of forces, and electron-proton masses, properties of neutrons. All of these things are very critical, as are the expansion rate, mass, and density of the universe. The Earth's orbit and tilt and rotation, magnetic field, atmosphere, and composition are all life-critical. If any of these things were just a little tiny bit different, there would not be life. Stephen Hawking said, "The remarkable fact is that the values of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life." Yeah? It's true. Penrose, Roger Penrose, said that an accuracy of one part in 10 to the 10 to the 123rd is the precision needed to set the universe on its course in order for us to develop the way we have. I work with big numbers. I can't even imagine how big that is. Remember, there are only 10 to the 80th atoms in the entire universe. 10 to the 123rd is a 1 with 123 zeros after it. 10 to the 10 to the 123rd is a 1 with 10 to the 123 zeros after it, which you can't even write with all the atoms in the universe. So, anyway. There is, for me, powerful evidence that there's something going on behind it all. It seems to me that somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming, so says physicist Paul Davies. Atheist Fred Hoyle writes, "A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with the physics." He was an atheist, but he could recognize, hey, something's going on here that defies scientific explanation. If we nudge one of these constants just a few percent, there's no carbon, no life, not even any chemistry, no complexity at all. Just a little bit. Astrophysicist Hugh Ross has a list of parameters that were taken from 650 astronomical and astrophysical research papers, and has 501 parameters in it. And the probability of all of those parameters being in the range that would support life, the probability of any place in the universe having all those characteristics is 1 part in 10 to the 311th power. It's a 1 with 311 zeros after it. So it really is quite amazing that we have life. But the Bible clearly says that he who fashioned and made the earth, he founded it. He did not create it to be empty, but he formed it to be inhabited. So it's no big surprise to a Bible-believing Christian that the earth supports life. Because that's how God created it. So it's no big surprise. But to get around some of the problems that and make excuses for the fine-tuning, because we know that we have life on this planet, therefore our universe must be one of multiple other universes. I talked about that a little bit before. And so the idea here is that all you really need is gravity, and you'll create the universe. And basically, that's nonsense. But the laws of physics are such that it just really it cannot work the way some people think it could. There's a very interesting book that I read a few years ago, written by Victor Stenger, called God, the Failed Hypothesis. He made some very interesting statements in it. He said, for example, a plausible scientific model need not be proven correct, just not proven incorrect. I'm not sure what kind of science he goes with, but and then he goes on later on, he says, the hypothesis of a God is falsified by the absence of data, which is contrary to what he just got done saying. And then he says, theists who argue that the universe is finely tuned to earthly life have the burden of proving that no other form of life is possible in every conceivable universe that has different physical parameters. How are you going to do that? every conceivable universe, you have to prove scientifically that it's impossible to have life on it. That's not science. And he goes on all kinds of other things that... he also says something that is laughable to me as a scientist. Well-understood physical and chemical processes are sufficient to account for the observed interaction between the various parts of living organisms. Complete nonsense. We'll talk a little bit about that as we get into information in life. But that's complete hooey. So, the origin of life was supposedly done in some warm little pool that created, used the water and hydrogen, methane, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, ammonia, and nitrogen to form the various components, which formed higher level components, which ultimately worked their way to form DNA and proteins and a membrane and ultimately a cell. Ooh, isn't that wonderful? So that's chemical. Once it forms a cell, then you can start biological evolution, supposedly. But until then, it's classified as chemical evolution. There was a scientist, Dean Kenyon, who wrote a book called Biochemical Predestination, saying this stuff is inevitable. And we still believe that because we're looking, whenever we land on another planet or moon or whatever, looking for life. Because we have life here, it must be elsewhere also. It's inevitable. They found water on Mars. Then there must be life. There's a big difference between water and life. Anyway, chemical evolution is broadly regarded as a highly plausible scenario for imagining how life on Earth might have begun. What has emerged over the last three decades is an alternative scenario which is characterized by destruction and not the synthesis of life. The undirected flow of energy through a primordial atmosphere and ocean is at present a woefully inadequate explanation for the incredible complexity associated with even the simplest living organisms. It's non-scientific to believe those things. Origin of life. I wrote a peer-reviewed paper that was called What Might a Protocell's Minimum Genome Be Like? And in that paper, I said basically, in order for a protocell, this is the cell before it became alive, it would have to be able to reproduce, and it would have to do that reliably and have evolvability, and it have to be replicable. But that would involve computer control, cybernetic control. Chemical metabolic networks are needed to admit and process the fuel and harness the energy for growth, reproduction, and manufacturing. Those are the requirements. Now, I didn't say that the title of the paper was What Might Be a Protocell's Minimum Genome. I didn't specify what that would be, but I just laid out the requirements that there would have to be in order for that to happen. And the requirements that I laid out have not ever been come close to in reality, nor will there ever be. But anyway, the origin of life remains one of the most vexing issues in chemistry, biology, and philosophy. Because there's lots of philosophy out there that poses a science when it comes to the origin of life. The challenge, as I wrote in my book in 2009, the challenge for an undirected origin of such a cybernetic, that's a computer-controlled, complex interacting computer system, is the need to demonstrate that the rules, laws, and theories that govern electronic computer computing systems and information don't apply to the even more complex digital information systems that are in living organisms. In the 100 trillion cells of your body, every single cell has literally millions of real computers and real computer programs. Every process that's biological is controlled by the processing of digital information. And I have two peer-reviewed papers in which I assert biology is not a physical science like chemistry and physics. Biology is an information science because it's the information science that controls the chemistry and physics that are used by life. And I verify that in my Programming of Life book as well. If we look at the probabilities of forming things that will match some of the life components, for example, the probability of forming a protein has been calculated as 1 part in 10 to the 175. That's a 1 with 175 zeros after it. That would be equivalent to winning the California Super Lotto 23 times in a row, buying one ticket each time. In case you're interested. Fred Hoyle's calculation of the probability of forming the enzymes that are required by life is 1 part in 10 to the 40,000th power. That's a 1 with 40,000 zeros after it. That would be like winning this California Super Lotto every Wednesday and Saturday for 50 years every time, buying one ticket each time. Not likely to happen. And the probability of finding forming a self-replicating cell is 1 part in 10 to the 340,000th, 40 millionth power, which is not likely at all. Some interesting observations. None of the papers that were published in the Journal of Molecular Evolution. The Journal of Molecular Evolution should describe how molecules evolve into life, chemical evolution. But none of the papers ever published in it from 1971 on has ever proposed a detailed model by which complex biochemical system might have been produced in a gradual, step-by-step Darwinian fashion. I find that intriguing. The level of complexity that's revealed at the molecular level have further strained the concept of random assembly. And it's hard to see how the chemicals could have formed the complicated nucleotides that are needed by life. Many of you may not realize what intelligent design is and how it differs from creationism, but intelligent design holds that certain features of the universe and living things are best explained by an intelligent cause and not by some undirected process such as natural selection. The fact that it's compatible with what the Bible teaches doesn't make it religious. In fact, in my book, I point out that until no one science can demonstrate feasible scenarios for the universe's fine-tuning and the informational features that are found in life, arising by undirected nature, science must recognize that intelligence is the only scientifically feasible source, making intelligent design a certainty based on known science. So based on known science, intelligent design is certain. Now you can speculate, maybe that's not true, but we know that intelligence can produce all kinds of things that are very improbable and make them work. But anyway, God is not connected with any theology. It's not a required belief. In fact, atheist Fred Hoyle said, "The intelligence which assembled the enzymes did not itself contain them, which by no means need be God, however." He was an atheist. He didn't believe in God, but he recognized that this is designed. So in his mind, the design came from some aliens. and we won't get into what he believed about that, but that's what he believed. Currently, science is restricted to undirected natural processes, and therefore you're not even allowed to consider intelligence or design or purpose. But in fact, intelligent design makes better sense and better science. The vestigial organs, there used to be 180 organs that were supposedly left over from the evolutionary process. Purposes have been found for every single one of those. It used to be thought that 98% plus of the DNA was junk DNA, because less than 2% of it coded for proteins. The rest was just junk. And for 30 years, it was declared to be junk. Until a couple of years ago, accumulation of 30 scientific papers of hundreds of scientists on many different nations published a bunch of papers verifying that 80% of the DNA has known function. It's not junk. God don't make junk. Anyway. But the best explanation for the observations, if we limit our science to a predetermined acceptable explanation, kind of begs the question, what if there is no natural explanation for it? Then what? We're going to waste our time and money and resources and everything else pursuing things that don't exist. The explanation of any phenomenon should make as few assumptions as possible, eliminating those that make no difference in the observable predictions in the explanatory hypothesis or theory. That's Occam's razor. There have been a lot of court rulings on belief systems. The Supreme Court has determined, for example, that implications of material alone do not make a religion, even if they coincide or harmonize with the tenets of some or all religions. So intelligent people say intelligent design is just creationism. It's not. It doesn't have anything to say directly about God or who the designer is, because that would be scientifically unknowable. We can determine scientifically that there was design, but we cannot determine scientifically that it was the God of the Bible, for example. Okay. In 1961, the Supreme Court said, among the religions of this world which do not teach what would generally be considered a belief in the existence of God are, among others, secular humanism, which is the religion of our secular school system. In an appellate decision, it was ruled that atheism is a religion. It's a belief system. And the group that he was in was religious in nature, even though it expressly rejected the belief in a supreme being. Atheism is a religion. So says the courts. 1961, the Supreme Court said, religious beliefs are based upon a faith to which all else is subordinate. Some believe in a purely personal God and others as a way of life. If you believe that everything arose by undirected natural processes, that's your religion. That's what the court says. Everything else is subservient to that belief. An example of some twisting of facts that affected me personally. Barbara Forrest, an atheist type of person who works for the National Center for Science Education, characterized me, one of the signers of the Louisiana statute of supporting the teaching of the things that evolution doesn't, that it fails in. And so she characterized me as being an ID apologist, an intelligent design apologist, with a background in computer programming. Forget the fact that I have two PhDs. It doesn't matter. I'm a programmer. Eugenie Scott also says, I'm a programmer. I never had the title programmer. Anyway, they forget about that. On the other hand, Larry Moran at the University of Toronto was writing about one of my books, and he said he has several common characteristics of intelligent design creationist proponents, multiple PhDs. I'm really intrigued by the fact that so many idiots have more than one PhD, because I hang out with real scientists all the time, and none of them has ever felt the need to be a graduate student more than once in their life. Oh, I see. I'm not a real scientist because I have two PhDs. Okay. Anyway, if they can't come at what they don't believe in one way, they'll try it by just throwing mud. The International Committee on Global Warming was very interesting. The Heidelberg appeal to that had 4,000 signatures, including 62 Nobel Prize winners. The Oregon petition had 31,000 accredited scientists. The Manhattan Declaration had 600 research climatologists. The petition to the United Nations had 100 geoscientists. And the statement from the American Physical Society had 150 physical scientists. The UN climate scientists speak out on global warming, 700 of them. Many previously were involved with the IPCC, and all of them are critical of the notion of man-made global warming. But the consensus is human beings are the cause of global warming. That's the consensus. That's the political consensus, and you better kowtow to that. But they're, in order to sign up to be part of the IPCC in the charter, it says the charter had to assess the risk of human-induced climate change. So if you wanted to get in on the money and everything else that goes with it, you better be able to show that humans are the cause. Otherwise, you're not going to get funded. But there are 53 authors and 5 reviewers, and those are all that can be said to explicitly support the claim of significant human influence on climate. Only 53 and 5 reviewers. Interesting. From the talk and the political talk, you would think every scientist believes in human-engineered global warming. Not so. Here's a chart of the global warming over the last 17 years. And it has gone up and down, as it normally does. But the models are shown here. The models show the increase in temperature going off the chart. The actual temperature is down here by a couple of different measurements. So it isn't at all settled science. People try to make it that way, but it isn't. It's political. A couple more things that are involved with science and integrity in science. In 1997, a U.S. law mandated that there was a registry of clinical trials that was mandated. And it was very interesting because they found in a study that in a sample of 55 large trials testing heart disease treatments, 57% of those published before 2000 reported positive effects after this mandate came in requiring that they make report their registration of the results. Afterwards, it plummeted to 8%, which is kind of interesting. There was a case against scholarly consensus. Consensus science is fairly popular nowadays, but the American Psychological Association basically concluded after some arm twisting and things that oh, it's okay to torture people to get information out of them. Interesting. But this case is a particularly disturbing example of a problem throughout the social sciences, the crafting of false consensus statements to promote ideological or political goals. False consensus does great and sometimes irreparable damage to science. In studies of Wikipedia, they discovered that controversial science topics are edited a lot more than normal topics. In fact, I'm a member of an intelligent design group, and people have said that they posted something to correct mistakes, and within seconds, it reverts back to what it used to be. They have people that are evidently looking, to change it back immediately. But basically, Wikipedia entries on politically controversial topics tend to be unreliable due to information sabotage. And all this stuff tarnishes the integrity of science. There was recently a California State University Northridge scientist who had a peer-reviewed paper published indicating that found a Triceratops dinosaur fossil that had soft tissue in the bones. And his conclusion was it must be just a few thousand years old rather than millions of years old. And it was published in a peer-reviewed science journal. But the university that he belonged to said, we're not going to tolerate your religion in this department. And they fired him. Because basically he was saying that dinosaurs are not nearly as old as what science tells us they were. Anyway, there have been lots and lots of scientific papers that have been retracted. At near the end of 2013, there were over 511 papers retracted in that year. And just this month, it said 64 more papers were retracted for fake reviews from Springer journals. That's a premier science publication outfit. There have been 1,500 papers retracted overall since 2012. People publish false findings, faked findings, whatever. When people find out about it, they're retracted. Scientific look at bad science. 2% of the scientists that were studied admitted to having fabricated, falsified, or modified data or results at least once, and as many as a third convinced to a variety of other questionable research practices, including dropping data points based on a gut feeling. That doesn't look right, so I'm just going to ignore that one. Or changing the design, methodology, or results of a study in response to pressures from source funding. Cigarette smoking doesn't do any harm. So anyway, many scientists blame the increase in competition for academic jobs and research funding combined with a publish-or-perish type of culture that causes this bad science to be published without really any scientific basis. One researcher wrote in Nature that when his team tried to reproduce 53 landmark cancer studies, should be pretty important, they could only replicate 6. So 6 out of 53 were the ones that were really scientific. The others weren't. That's kind of scary. Social sciences suffer from severe publication bias because things that don't show positive results don't get published. If you study something and it doesn't show what you expected it to show, you don't publish it. Rather than publishing it saying, this is what I found, it doesn't work. Which is what would be reasonable. If you spend some time studying something and it doesn't work, you should be able to publish that as it doesn't work. So don't try this. It won't work. But science really is really poisoned by only hearing about successes. And there's Common Core. Common Core educational program. It takes from parents their primary right regarding the education of their children. It frustrates the purpose of education with the goal of making college and career-ready students. It has standardized teaching and testing, and it seeks to create a massive machine of education. Common Core standards require children's personal information to be provided into a database that can be expected to sell or share to unspecified companies. Kind of scary. It has devastating impact on literary study and analytical thinking. For example, one of the Common Core civics assignment is to revise the Constitution's outdated Bill of Rights. Obviously, that's obsolete. Let's write a better one. Now, I have a couple minutes, so let me just talk a little bit about my favorite topic, computers in life. I'm a computer scientist. Richard Dawkins says, the machine code of a genes is uncannily computer-like. Apart from differences in jargon, the pages of a molecular biology journal might be interchanged with those of a computer engineering journal. Interesting. Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft, said, human DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. So if I said, the Windows 8 operating system that's running on this computer just arose by undirected natural processes through an evolutionary process, how many of you would say, yeah, I believe that? No. It took years of intelligent people writing software for that to happen. A very, very important thing happened back in 2010. Craig Venter, biologist, his group extracted the DNA from one type of bacterium, and they cobbled together a strand of DNA that matched a different type of bacterium. They inserted that manufactured DNA into that cell whose DNA was extracted, did some other operations, and that cell became alive, taking on the characteristics of the injected DNA. Now, what that proved, well, Greg Ventner said, life is basically the result of an information process, a software process. Our genetic code is our software. Now, that software that they injected was read by the computer hardware that was already in that cell. They didn't replace that. So he proved experimentally the existence of computer hardware and software in everything that is alive, which is something I've been saying for many years. And he verified it experimentally. So in the statement that the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like, no. It is computer code. It's not just like computer code, it is computer code. Richard Dawkins is like a human being. No, anyway, we'll go on. So what is a computer? The people look at a computer, well, this is a computer, obviously, it's an electronic computer. But that's not the only kind of computer there is. All you really need for a computer is to have input or embedded data, memory and internal transfer, program to tell it what to do, processing capability, and the capability to produce meaningful output. And biological computers have that, electronic computers have that, and that mechanical computer that you saw in the previous slide also did that. But it's important to realize that every single protein of the 100,000 proteins that are generated by your body, every single one of them is the result of the execution of a real computer program. There are millions of real computer programs in every cell. And there are 100 trillion cells in your body. That's a lot of computer programs. So there's a whole bunch of things in my book. I won't go into them now because there's not time. But these things require scientific explanations. Like, for example, how did nature write the prescriptive programs needed to organize life's metabolism? You have this dead material. How did it know enough to write the programs to do metabolism? Because metabolism is controlled by computer in life cells. And so forth down the line, a whole bunch of it. How did it solve the problems and write the programs? How did it have the generating messages and encryption and just all kinds of stuff that life's complexity is involved with? Here's a good one. Every complex program in computer science requires what's called top-down design and implementation. You design the thing at the top level, you break it down in further and further, and finally you write the code at the very bottom. That's not the way supposedly it happens in life. In life, supposedly, it starts at the very bottom and works its way up. You modify the programs at the very lowest level. By the way, evolution says you have an existing organism that has existing computer programs in it. Those computer programs are randomly changed by random changes in your computer programs, and they produce better computer programs. Oh, yeah? Since when can that happen? Anyway. Speculation and integrity in science, it's important for scientists to be able to speculate things so that they can test them out, see if they work. But we need to, as science needs to be able to avoid proclaiming the speculations as some sort of scientific truth. You see it all the time. Well, this man-made experimental result that does some very weird things on pure elements and very carefully controlled elements. Well, maybe that's what happened for the origination of life. Well, that's a computer, it's a complete controlled experiment that you're doing. It has nothing to do with the origin of life. It's a very interesting chemical experiment. Nothing to do at all with origin of life. And consequently, if you proclaim that to the world, they might believe it, which is, I think, a mistake. The argument that we don't know yet how this feature can arise by undirected natural processes, but we will someday, is not a scientific statement. It is a faith statement based on naturalism of the gaps, dogma, which has no more scientific validity than the appeal to the God of the gaps as an explanation for complex systems. So if you say, I don't know how this happened, but we will someday, that's not science. That's faith in scientism. Anyway. So I have a website, and I've had it for many years, called Science Integrity, where I try to expose the unsubstantiated scientific claims. And I've written several books, and a lot of them are out there that you're welcome to get. By the way, if you buy one of my books for $5, you'll get a free DVD of the new Programming of Life 2 and Programming of Life 1 on one DVD. So it's free. Okay.